continue the, now to talk about the idea of covenant and how that gets developed. The very first people to receive one were Adam and Eve, according to Genesis. And I don't mean the very first contact with God. That was pre-covenantal. They were put on probation. But then after that, God did make a covenant. He promised that there would be a descendant of theirs in the future who would turn around and defeat the tempter, defeat Satan on their behalf. And so there's already the promise of a covenant hero to come, and they are placed under covenantal restraints. They are still given duties to perform and things they're not to do and so on. And so again, I said that the main ideas of the covenant... I see we're having some trouble here. Where God's demands and God's promises. And the demands are love, faith, or trust, and obedience. And the main promises are God's love, forgiveness, and everlasting life. And I find that to be going on even very early there with Adam, because of the way it's phrased that God put his spirit into Adam, the spirit of real eternal life. And so that's how I see the Genesis 2 stuff unfolding. And then we get the story that the descendants, the covenant people, or were to pass the covenant on to their descendants, and their descendants were to multiply and become more numerous. And the story, as the story unfolds, that the covenant people, the men, take wives from pagan sources. They don't marry within their faith, and they bring pagan religion, they bring false religion in to their lives, and they mix it until these people who know the truth, who have been handed it because God gave it to them, and they've been raised in it, turn their backs and live the lives of practicing pagans, and God comes and is terribly angry with them for it, and then he then decides to punish them. Since they were the people who knew that their lives depended on standing in right relation to him, and they turned their backs on him, he sends a flood and wipes them out. Again, the expression, the breath of life, comes from Genesis 2:7, and God breathed into him the neshama, his own spirit of life. Those are the people that have that get wiped out by the flood. In other words, they're the people who had been given God's spirit and God's truth, and they were now to be punished, and only Noah survives. So the custodian of the covenant passes from Adam to Noah. And then we're told that the prophecy is that it's one son of Noah. He has three sons, but his son Shem is the one who will inherit custodial care of the covenant to pass it on. And then in the story, we're told about a Shemite, we say now Semite, Abraham, who's a descendant of Shem. And the covenant is passed, torch is passed on to him, and God makes his covenant with Abraham and says, your descendants, you and your descendants will be my covenant people. And we can put this roughly in time, because Adam's sons are both, one said to be a farmer and one's a shepherd. We know that they had to live somewhere around 10,000, 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. That's when farming and animal husbandry began to arise, we know from archaeology. And and I don't think that the story means to suggest that they're the very first people in the world either, because when their son is sentenced by God for the murder of his brother, it says he moves to another city, another land, and marries there and has a family. And if the writers of the story thought that they that Adam and Eve and their two sons were the only four people on earth, they certainly would have felt compelled to explain how he could go to another place and marry there, and why he was worried about what the people there would think of him, and so on. They would have raised that, but they weren't assuming that there were only four people on the earth, as I read it. So now it passes to Noah, and then to Shem, and then to Abraham, and we can roughly date Abraham as about 2,000 before the birth of Christ. So Abraham lived roughly as long before Jesus was born as we live after. And the story then of Abraham and his sons and how the covenant is passed down to them as well, and to Joseph, and to Abraham's descendants, eventually becoming the tribes of Israel. Abraham, Isaac, his son, and Jacob, his son. And Jacob has 12 sons, become progenitors of the 12 tribes of Israel. And then it is they who, in a time of famine, travel to Egypt in order to try to get food. And are taken under the protection of the Pharaoh there because of the intercession of their brother. That's the story of the captivity. Is a poignant one, and we have that in the Old Testament as well. A new Pharaoh takes the throne and decides to oppress these foreigners living within the borders of his kingdom and force them into slave labor. And he also makes a decree that they seem to be multiplying too rapidly for his pleasure. So from now on, all baby boys born will be executed. And then you have the story of the birth of Moses and Moses' mother not obeying that law, but putting him in a little basket boat and pushing it toward where the Pharaoh's daughter takes her morning bath in the river. And then the Pharaoh's daughter adopts him, and he becomes part of the Egyptian court. And that's how he knows Egyptian language and lore. He's educated as an Egyptian, though he's a Jew. And that takes us down then to the time of Moses. And this is roughly 1250, give or take. Nobody's exactly certain of these dates. But this is important stuff now, because God reestablishes his covenant, and this time with Moses, and part of the covenant promises the rescue of the people from their slavery in Egypt. And this is what issues in the Passover. And this is a great story. And again, it's absolutely supposed to be historical. And if it's not, then it's not true. In a way that nothing becomes untrue in Hinduism and Buddhism if no historical event corresponds to it. But God appears to Moses. And Moses has run away from Egypt because he's wanted for murder. He's hiding out in the desert, and he takes a job as a shepherd. And while he's watching these flocks, he sees a bush and it's blazing away, but not being consumed. It's not being burned up. And so he goes over to see it, and the voice says, "I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of your fathers. Take your shoes off. This is holy ground." And God issues to Moses a call to service. You are going to be the one who's going to lead the people out of slavery. And Moses says, "They're not going to listen to me. I don't even know who to say sent me." And God says, "You tell them." And then he gives his sacred name. And for a long time, we had no idea how to pronounce that, because these are only consonants in Hebrew, and there were no vowels. And that's the way old Hebrew was written, till a group of scholars called the Masoretes found a way to add vowels by making little dots and squiggles and lines to represent the vowels. But they never did fill that in, and so no one knew how to pronounce it. And some translators of the King James Bible guessed that this was a J. It's Hebrews read right to left. This is an H, and they guessed that this was a V, and this was an H, and so they guessed it was pronounced Jehovah. And so that's the way they translated it. But since that time, we have found a manuscript, I think it was in Arabic, which actually did supply the vowels, and that guess was wrong. And the right way to pronounce it is Yahweh. And Jews, as a practice of respect, since this was unpronounced for so long, still don't pronounce it. And when they read the writings, when they read the scriptures in the synagogue and so on, they come to this, they'll usually use the term Adonai, the Lord, but they won't pronounce God's sacred name. It's a form of the verb to be. So in the English Bible, when Moses says to God, "I don't know who to say sent me," the translation is, "Tell them that I am has sent you." And one scholar has said that the more exact way to read it would be, "The one who causes to be." That's equivalent to creator, the one who causes to be. So it's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of creation, who is calling Moses to this task to lead his people out of slavery and captivity and into a land of their own where they can serve him and not constantly be surrounded by the Egyptian polytheism. Now, a lot of research has turned up knowledge about what covenants were like at this time. And there was one in particular that was very popular, widely used, between 2,000 and 1,000 years before Christ. And it was called a suzerainty treaty. This is a U. A suzerain is the name for a conquering king. The conquering king could do anything he wanted with the people he just conquered. He could enslave them. He could execute them. But a suzerainty treaty was a merciful treaty. It was a treaty in which he now appealed to the conquered people to become part of his kingdom and tried to establish a better relationship merely than, "I was the guy that beat the heck out of your army on the field." So a suzerainty treaty had standard parts. It ran like this. First, there is the identity of the king. So it would start out with something like, I'm King Rumpus O'Bumpus, and I met your armies on the plains of whatever, and my chariot smeared yours, and my guys laid your army down low, and we defeated you royally. And then there's a command to loyalty. One of them reads like this, you Depi Teshub, turn your eyes to no other, and don't serve any other, and don't make any treaty with any other. See, but in those days, they tried to keep the opposing king alive, because he was going to keep on ruling his people, but he was going to be a puppet for the suzerain. So a lot of the commands, a lot of these suzerainty treaties are with the conquered king, specifically. It's command to loyalty. And then, following that, there's a list of threats and promises. Here's what's going to happen if you break this treaty. My guys are going to roll in, and we're going to make life so miserable for you, you'll be sorry you were ever born. We're going to put you in a vat of pus. We're going to force feed you. And I won't go on. The ancient Near Eastern guys had a vivid imagination when it came to punishments. But if you keep my covenant, then you're going to be able to use our coinage, and it's worth more than yours. You'll have access to our ports. You're going to be prosperous in a way you weren't before. Our army is going to protect your land from the marauders that live in the hills and so on. There's a whole bunch of threats and promises. And there's a specific way that these treaties were made. The conquering king called the conquered king to a meal. The conquered king had to come in with all the nobility of that country and sit at the conquering king's table, accept his hospitality, have this read, and then there's a swearing in ceremony. It's ratified by them hearing it, and then they stand and swear to keep it forever. And to do that, it's always made in two copies. One copy is kept by the conquering king, one is given to the conquered king and his nobles, and they take it home. And then there is a promise that the conquered king has to have a yearly reading of the suzerainty treaty to all his elders, all his nobles. And again, they're to re-swear every year. They reread it, and they re-swear to keep it. That's the what surrounds the making of a suzerainty treaty then. And I want to point out to you why I've taken the time to explain all this. This is the way Exodus starts, doesn't it? With God saying, giving his law to Moses, I'm the Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I've brought you with dry shoes across the Red Sea, out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. Before me is a covenant expression. It means make no covenant with any other god. When Moses is said to have eaten the meal on the sacred mountain and sworn to keep God's covenant, they ate the meal before the Lord. That's in covenant relation to him. So before doesn't mean before in the list of your gods or in my sight. It means covenant, a covenant agreement. You're to have no other covenant with any other gods. And then what follows is such things as honor your father and your mother, so that your days may be long in the land that I give you. That's a veiled threat, right? If you don't honor your father and mother, your days aren't going to be long. And there are also promises. I visit the sins of the fathers, the first and second generation of those that hate me, but I show mercy to the thousandth generation of them that fear me and keep my commandments. So there are threats and promises in the rest of the law. And Moses and the elders of Israel were told to come into that mountain into the mountain and eat a meal before the Lord and swear to keep his covenant forever. And the law was given in two copies, two stones. Deuteronomy says written, they were each written on both sides. So it isn't 1 to 5 and 6 to 10. It's 10 on each, two copies. And there's a prescription that every year it's to be gotten out and read to all the elders and the nobility of Israel, and they are all to swear to re-keep it. In other words, it's a perfect match. What God did in giving the law to Moses was to give it in the form of a suzerainty treaty, and that was clear to all the people that what this meant was that God was their suzerain, God was their king, and that they were his subjects, and that they had this law to live by, and that they were his people. When we meet again next time, we'll talk about other re-givings, reiterations of the covenant, and the ways in which they fared in Israel.